right or not, but I didn't see that as the time to sit and consult with ICANN, but that do it beforehand because, I don't think who his policy changes so often that there should be any major surprises along the way.
Yeah, exactly. So here's I was going to propose something along the lines of the general rule is registrars and registries don't have to have the ability to change their WHOIS practices in order to comply with local and national laws. And then the two caveats to that, I guess, are number one is that in all cases, if they are required to make such a change, that they notify ICANN in advance. And it doesn't have to be, it could be, or concurrently even, but they have to notify ICANN that they're making the change. I think that was a concept that we all expressed support for previously. And then secondly, that where applicable and appropriate, that they could go through this. I mean, we can work on the language to get to what is applicable and appropriate, but where applicable and appropriate, they can also work through this consultative process if they're not under the gun in terms of time or a specific order or something like that in order to comply with the specific instance where they've been approached by a data commissioner or something like that and need to act immediately. Does that strike the right balance between sort of the desire to consult for general changes maybe made preemptively and then also have the ability to act quickly and if a registrar or registry needs to do so?
George, if may, let me ask a general question. You know, one of the things that I think none of us would want to see is a potpourri of different approaches out there that are very confusing to the users. And I want to keep in mind this against the idea that over time there needs to be, if we're going to change who is, there needs to be a framework for uniformity and consistency to the greatest extent possible.
Yeah, Marilyn, I think the general goal is that the work of this task force and the other WHOIS task forces is going to provide that general framework. And
yeah.
The point here is if we miss something or if a data commissioner comes along and says, you know what, that's great for every country except for Swaziland,
right.
But here,
right.
You know, we have our own crazy laws, then at least the registrar or registry has the ability to do something without getting hauled off to jail.
Yeah, but are we suggesting that the registrar is going to change the entirety of access for every other country or only for that country?
I'm suggesting that, the purpose of, I would guess, I mean, and once again, this is where refining the language may help a little, but I would guess that the rule is that they make a set of changes required to comply. And that's part of the reason why they provide notice to ICANN is so that ICANN can review and say, okay, well, you're changing a lot more than you really need to in order to comply with your local data commissioner and can work it out. I mean, the consultation may in those cases happen after the fact rather than before the fact if they're under the gun to do something in order to comply with a directive being made to them by a government agency. But in all cases, ICANN knows about it and can sort of make the call as to whether or not they think it's appropriate.
Jordan, this is Steve. Can I comment on this?
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I think we can probably come up with language, but I think the preferred outcome is a consultative process. I think that would be best for the users of the service and the users of the Internet. Marilyn points out consistency is quite important. I think that would be best for ICANN. I think that would be best for the registrar in terms of fulfilling its contractual obligations. And I think in many cases it will be welcomed by a data protection authority who says, look, we've alerted you to a problem. See if you can fix it. And if you can't fix it, then we'll tell you what you have to do. Or if we're not satisfied with the result, we'll tell you what you have to do. But I think in many cases, having a consultative process in place would be helpful to registrars in responding to the data protection. Rather than saying, yes, we'll make these changes and we'll find out later whether we're in violation of our contract and risking our accreditation, they would be able to say, here's a process for trying to work this out so that ICANN is comfortable and the data protection authorities. And so I think that that ought to be the preferred route, with obviously some type of escape hatch in case in which that simply is not possible to do because of the things that government authorities take. This is all very hypothetical.
Right, yeah. I mean, this whole thing is intended as a sort of escape hatches, I guess, with various levels of escape.
I'm not sure how hypothetical any of this is.
Well, but my suggestion was simply that ICANN should have a procedure to set up this, and I think that would be useful, as I said, to all the parties involved if it provided a way to try to resolve these problems without the legal issue or a contract.
Kathy?
Yeah, Kathy, anyone else want to speak? Okay, go ahead, Kathy.
I'd be really interested in knowing what Tom thinks, since he's going to be the one kind of on the line when the data protection commissioners or others come, others in law enforcement come. But I was going to say, we heard a lot about responding quickly to law enforcement in our last call. And I still think I think the way Jordan drafted this, you get to respond first and then notify and consult later, which one would think is the right way to deal with law enforcement and government agencies.
Right. Well, just to be clear, what I'm proposing is if a response is required, if an immediate response is required, the registrar does that and notifies ICANN. If the notice is more general or the registrar believes that there is a conflict but hasn't yet been placed on notice or something like that, then the consultative process applies.
Well, if you want to hear my view, Kathy, I could live with such a scenario, what Jordan just described. I mean, we only have the problem that if we need to do changes in our WHOIS policy, we should be allowed to. So if there's some sentence from some official lawmaking institute, whatever, we should be allowed to do so on short notice and not go to any kind of consultation. But on the other hand, to kind of establish an international standard might be a good thing to have a consultation process in some way. So if someone just feels that they might be in breach, that should not be enough of a reason just to modify his policy, but he should be in a situation where he has to prove that there is a concrete basis on why he's changing who is. And if there isn't, he should go through the consultation process with ICANN if possible, but at least with his data protection authorities. So I could live with that as long as the main principle is that the registrars and the registries can change their WHOIS privacy to reflect their privacy laws at home.
Makes sense.
Right, so are we getting to a place, Steve, it sounded like you know, obviously want to preserve the consultation, but you're comfortable if there is that sort of escape hatch if need be, and if there's the specific requirement to perform in a timely manner?
Yeah, I think I could modify the proposal to reflect that.
Yeah, I think actually what we may do, you know, just thinking about how we've allocated work, I think Tom's got the national law section. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, so could you maybe take a stab then at incorporating what we've just discussed into Steve's proposal?
Sure.
And come up with the hybrid?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So we'll see that as part of your contribution then. So let's move on to the proxy services discussion. So I think, you know, where we landed as, in terms of proxy services, I think we generally agreed that we weren't in a position to be making policy recommendations at this point on proxy services, and the goal was to encourage, I guess, some more work and perhaps formulation of best practices with regard to the proxy services, but that we weren't going to have time to do that, and that we didn't want to see any specific recommendations coming out other than more investigation. And I think, Steve, you were just attempting to write up sort of the framework of what that more investigation should look like. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I circulated something on May 2nd. And And then Kathy had a response to that, which I think could be incorporated. I think she had some other questions that she wanted to have looked at for their research.
Right, Kathy, do you want to, is that correct? You just wanted to add some additional questions to be looked at?
I did want to add some additional questions, as long as we're putting through questions, and those are in the Word document that was attached for whoever's writing up this section. But I also kind of was concerned. Steve's approach was very neutral, which makes sense, but given the comments that have been received and the data gathering that's been done, I think some serious questions have been raised regarding the proxy services, both those that are done by third parties and those that are done by registrars. And Team 2 presented a lot of data on this, and you also got some constituency statements raising the concern that proxy registrations aren't any form of anonymous speech, that the data is being given out at the proxy's discretion, and that people are in real trouble, particularly when it's a third-party proxy that goes bankrupt or something like that. They're often unable to get their domain names out. So there are a number of questions have been raised regarding proxies from domain name holders. So I think that I'm not sure I'd be as neutral, and that's what I posted, as neutral as Steve would have us. I think we should talk about the seriousness of the questions that have been raised by the proxies as a prelude for all the detail and all the future data gathering that we might recommend for a future PDP. I don't know if that makes sense, but there are a lot of concerns about proxies.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think there's concerns on both sides of the proxy situation, but I guess I'm trying to, if we're just recommending additional sort of data gathering work to be done at some point in the future, how do you get away from, presumably you want data gathering work to be fairly neutral as opposed to policy work, which is
you do, but a lot of
additive.
People, right, that makes sense. But a lot of people out there are opposing the proxy as kind of the ultimate solution. Why should we have any privacy in the two-way system if we have proxies, they can do it all for us? And I think as part of the report, we should say, real questions have been raised about the proxy services. This is not, nobody's presenting this as the ultimate answer right now. At least that's what I'd like to see in it, because I think those questions were raised at the data gathering phase and at the constituency statement phase. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think all of this should be kind of reflected in the final report.
Sure. Well, I think it's fair. I mean, I think it would be a fair assessment to say that since we're not making policy recommendations with regard to proxies, that we don't view them as being sort of a magic bullet to solve the problems of that have been presented to the task force.
Well, I guess that part would actually go into the findings and not into the recommendations.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct, Thomas.
Well, I was planning to include with the findings section a summary of various statements we had links to the various statements we heard about proxy services and to the various arguments, as far as I can recall them. So I'm relatively positive that this will be in the document, but not in the recommendation section. Then. Does that make sense, Kathy?
I think a lot of people are going to go straight to the recommendations.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I mean, we can't say that we're... I mean, the recommendations are things that we're suggesting that be done, and we can't say that we suggest that nothing be done on proxies.
No,
I mean, that's all we can say, really. I mean, we're encouraging some additional work. There's nothing. There's no negative finding, really, to be made in terms of a recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, I think your recommendation would be along the lines of, we recommend that there be further study in this area or something like that.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what Steve's proposed, and I think Kathy's proposed a few additional bits. Does that make sense, Kathy?
It does, as long as it's clear to people that why we're recommending action. I would think because we're a bit concerned about this.
Yeah, well, I think there's two levels. I mean, I think Steve and some others have raised a whole different set of concerns about the proxy services, but I agree that there's significant concerns, and we don't. The task force, I think, doesn't view them as being an area where we want as productive enough to be at this point sort of where we wanted to focus our efforts in terms of policy recommendations until there's further study done.
Great. Thank you.
Steve, were you trying to jump in there at some point?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, I guess I'll just await what Thomas drafts on the point.
Okay. Okay, so Steve, you had presented one more set of recommendations that you drafted in the past.
I had presented something on obtaining consent from registrants.
Right, right. And that
I don't know if there were any comments.
Yeah, that's what I was just wondering, if everyone had a chance to look at those and if there were any comments. I mean, I think Maggie's, to a certain extent, incorporated them into her, some of that into her document that just barely got distributed. So we'll probably, I guess, see maybe some additional commentary on this next, as we start to look at the actual report. Steve, have you had a chance to look at what Maggie drafted up?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So, I mean, the real question is whether or not she's captured sort of what you're after and vice versa. But we'll defer that, I guess, until next week's dialogue.
Jordan, you mean just because I wasn't the only one, I was the only one who finished my homework, it shouldn't just be adopted as a...
no, unfortunately.
I think that should be a rule.
As much as I'd love to agree with that, actually the version of the document that was sent out by Glenn is unreadable, at least for me. It's a windmail.bat file, and I'm not using Windows, so I can't read it.
It's all a conspiracy, Tom.
Yeah,
great, thanks. It will help to read it before everybody agrees to it by default.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Glenn. So I want to jump, we've got about 10 or 15 more minutes. I wanted to jump back to see if we can't make any, we had, I think, come to some broad agreements, well, maybe, last time in terms of tiered access. And I was going to try to capture those, but since we've had a little bit of an extension in terms of time, this does seem like a place where it might be worth a little bit more discussion, because I think it is where we've made some progress, but there's still some significant issues remaining to be resolved at the same time. And one thing that there were a couple of, I guess, open issues that we had started to discuss as being not yet resolved on our last call. And I wanted to see, if we might have some discussion around them, at least to add some more color to the document, or maybe to see whether or not some of them might be able to be resolved as we go on before the report is published. The less sort of remaining things to be done between now and the final report or now and implementation, I think the better. So I think last time we had discussed the issues that had not yet been agreed upon or where we had additional questions were, first, the means available for identification and authentication, what was there and whether they were fast, affordable, and online. The second was what contact data should be shown in the protected tier. The third is it reasonable to notify registrants when their data is distributed other than, and I think we've added on the exception, other than through legal or contractual obligations. So those are the sort of outstanding questions we had on the
Jordan,
two.
Yeah. This is Kathy. I apologize. When you heard the click off, I was disconnected. So on that list, I apologize. Could you repeat that?
Sure. The list is the outstanding questions we had on tiered access that we'd identified in our last call were, first, the means available for identification and authentication and whether or not they were fast, affordable, and online. Second, what contact data should be shown in the protected tier. And third, is it reasonable to notify registrants when their protected data is accessed other than by legal or contractual obligations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to maybe just dive back into a few of these of these conversations, especially maybe the third one to start with, because we had some dialogue on that last time that due to time constraints, we may run into the same problem we sort of stopped short of. And I think, you know, the last caveat that we just discussed is something we added on, and I don't know if that actually meets, you know, some of the concerns that have been raised by Maggie and I think maybe even Marilyn, were that, you know, in some cases law enforcement or other legitimate reasons to get access to the data without such a notification occurring. But I guess the question is, if we add on the caveat, you know, except where legal or contractual requirements exist to provide that data, does that get us any closer to making anyone comfortable with the idea that the registrant is notified when their protected data is accessed? I open that up to ideally Maggie or Steve, or I think Marilyn had some comments on that before as well.
Jordan, this is Steve. I'm not quite sure I understand what you're asking. You say legal or contractual obligation to disclose?
Sorry. I'm going off notes from last time, so I guess I'm not being quite as clear as I could be. But I guess the idea is we've discussed in the past. Kathy had put in her sort of compromise proposal the idea that the registrant, the requester's information identification be disclosed to the registrant whenever the protected information was accessed. And then some objections were raised to that, and I guess Thomas had suggested that an exception might be made for situations in which there was a legal or contractual basis for the information to be disclosed. So I guess in the case of law enforcement, that would be a subpoena or whatever, or a UDRP panel because there's an existing contractual relationship, or between registrars for transfers because there's that contractual requirement, as opposed to just, I don't want to say a random person, but a person coming in from the outside and identifying themselves, but not necessarily having one of those predefined relationships to the name and getting access to it. Is that clear, Steve?
And your question is?
My question is, so does the exception that Thomas proposed make you any more comfortable with the idea of providing notification to the registrant when their protected information is accessed?
Well, no, in a word, because I think there is not a true symmetry here between someone who has registered a domain name and is using it, and someone who's a member of the public or who has an intellectual property right or a parent or wants to know who they're dealing with online. I don't think the price of finding that out should be that you're just if your identity and all your contact information is disclosed to the register.
And it's Marilyn, if I could follow up on that, George. You know, we are assuming, if you're a parent checking on that happens to be an area that I've done a fair amount of work in. If you're a parent checking on a website that your child is visiting, it may be perfectly legitimate website. It distributes music. It distributes games, something of that nature. What you're trying to do is find out who your child, that website is holding itself out to communicate with the public. You know, I think one of our problems is we have this tension between where we think it's truly an individual who is putting up a website for their personal use, their child's birthday party, whatever, free speech, whatever, and this larger social issue, which has to do with people being able to determine who they're interacting with, both individuals and companies and others, along the lines that Steve was saying.
Right, so are you suggesting that perhaps different standards ought to apply to different types of registrants? Well, that's a discussion we've had in the past and generally concluded no, but are you maybe wanting to revisit that or suggesting something else?
That's a discussion we had in the past, and I think the task force has to take into account the implementability of any policy recommendations they make. And so if that's not implementable, because the registrars would bear too big a cost to authenticate who a registrant is, that may be a reason not to do that. But I'm saying to ask someone who contacts the website to provide a lot of information about themselves because they're trying to verify who the website operator is seems to me to have the same privacy concerns that have been raised by others about the registrant who knowingly registers a website. When you register for a domain name, you know you're registering for a domain name, you know you're putting up a website, you know you're holding yourself out to communicate with the public. That is an act of knowing versus someone who's accessing who is to try to find out who their child is interacting with or who they themselves are interacting with. And
Can I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead. Marilyn, why don't you finish up first?
Yeah. So, you know, I think we have to consider both sides of that, and that's all I thought that Steve was proposing, is that we do need to consider both sides of that if we're asking the contactor to provide a lot of information. We're going to have to take into account those same privacy questions.
Thanks, Marilyn. Okay, Thomas, did anyone else want to...
Maggie,
anyone else?
Tom.
Okay, go ahead, Thomas.
Several points. First of all, Marilyn, you're saying if someone registers a domain name, they're planning to use it for a website, and they're planning to hold out themselves to communicate with the public. That's a set of very big assumptions that some users may have for a domain name. You may also use a domain name just for email. No website, that's entirely possible. You may use a domain name for a private website. You may be putting up a defensive registration where you don't want to apply for the domain name. That's registering domain names too without holding out yourself to communicate with the public. So this leads to a question. Why does, if someone holds themselves out to communicate with the public, I don't have much of an issue with identifying them, although we get into the speaker's registry discussion here, so there is an anonymity caveat to this. But let's assume they hold themselves out to communicate with the public through some channel, such as a website. Why does the identifying information have to be disclosed by the registrar? We are talking about registering a domain name that can be used for many things, just because it's often, not always, used to hold yourself out to communicate to the public. We now make the conclusion that everybody has to make their information available through the registrar, not make it available themselves. But the second point, the proposal that has been made includes an important remark. Tier 1 has very limited information. Unless the registrant asks that more be published, no information is information true, is information too, and it may be the information you need to determine that you do not want to communicate and interact with that particular party. If no information is available, if the party is staying more or less anonymous, then you have the liberty to decide you do not want to communicate to them. That's just as much information as saying Mr. Evil. No information can lead you to the very same conclusions. So, from a user's point of view of usefulness, I don't think your argument actually works here. If you want to figure out if you have to communicate to someone, it's entirely enough to know, do they give me information voluntarily or don't they? If they don't give that information, you are entirely free not to communicate and to ignore them. And in a market economy, they will feel it if that happens frequently, and they will have to change and give the information freely. That's one point. The second point is we are hearing that the same privacy concerns apply to requesters as they apply to registrants. True, entirely true. But why are we ignoring registrants? Are we hearing proposals to ignore registrant privacy concerns all along the way, but to pay the greatest attention to privacy concerns of the requesters. That doesn't make sense to me. The compromise proposal we have on the table right now does not take registrant privacy concerns into account, because essentially the basic construction of having this information available for a relatively great population of data users makes it impossible to take care of these privacy concerns. The very least thing, then, should be that this large, unspecified population of data users be treated the same way as registrants are treated. My privacy concerns as a registrant are not fully addressed. Fine. The same thing should apply to the privacy concerns of data users. I think it's really pure reciprocity here. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Thomas. Maggie?
Oh, let's see. I'm trying to remember what I was going to say. Oh, essentially, I guess what the portion of the so-called compromise proposal that is really bothersome for me is where a notice is sent to the registrant each time. I think that is not practical, and I would like to see that be removed. Trying to think of something that, you know, can kind of be suitable to both sides so we're not so polarized. And if anyone has any suggestions on that, I would love to hear them. I haven't quite been able to come up with anything, but that's the part that's really sticking out in my mind right now. Undoable for us.
Maggie, is that a concern with the specific implementation proposal that's in there sending an email? Or is it a concern with the basic policy idea making that identity available?
Both. The main part of it being to notify the registrant that someone has requested access or requested information about them.
Maggie, last time when we talked about this, you had identified that, you know, that certain activities, you know, obviously need to operate under sort of a cloak of stealth.
Right.
Law enforcement obviously being an excellent example of that. Do you think that those also extend, those situations also extend outside of where one of those, I guess my question is it possible to identify a list of such activities and say these are exempt from that requirement and say, but, you know, generally speaking, if you are, you know, just requesting the information because you're curious about it or something like that, that then the notification would be provided?
I didn't hear her drop off. I'm wondering if maybe something happened with the...
Oh, I'm sorry. My mute button was on.
Oh, sorry. There we go.
okay, I think the last statement was just trying to answer Jordan's question, right? I'm sitting here just talking to myself, and you guys can't hear me. But I think that could work, although I want to stress that both the civil and criminal law investigation, law enforcement activities would have to be included. But we almost get into some of the same problems as trying to authenticate registrants. Again, how would we know if someone is just trying to be curious or someone has a more specific concern? You know, I mean, I'm not really opposed to that, but just ironing out the details and trying to figure out exactly how it would work would be the difficulty.
Right. Now, I think regardless, there's a lot of implementation work to be done anywhere near the TIRDAX proposal. So I don't disagree with that at all. So that gets you at least more comfortable than the general broad swath of every time there's a notification.
Yeah, I would definitely want to run it by my other constituency members, but for me personally, it gets a little bit closer.
Right, and I'm getting, Steve, I'm getting from you that that doesn't get you any closer because your concern is more sort of philosophical in that you don't see the symmetry between the two parties, and that might be true for Marilyn as well.
Well, I don't see the symmetry, and I also think that, say, in theory, that this would be excessive. I mean, it further complicates the process, which is already pretty complicated, that the registrar or somebody would have to make a decision about not only whether a person could get into a certain system, get back to that question, but also whether, once they're in the tier, also send this notification to register. In other words, it's subdividing the tier, if you will. So it just further complicates the eight questions about who decides and by what criteria.
Sure, right. Yeah, understood that it does complicate the implementation somewhat more. Okay, sorry. Tom was in the queue to make other comments, I think. Let me jump to him.
Well, yes. Mainly, Thomas took all my points I wanted to raise, but the only thing I want to ask Marilyn and Steve is if they want to find out who's the owner of the website, I mean, in the way we formed Tier 1 right now, you can still find out who that person or company is and where they're settled, at least in which country. And that should give you a good enough idea about who that person is. I mean, that's expressed. You know, it should just be fine for that. The only thing I don't understand why for such needs or, just to figure out who is who, you would need his personal information like telephone number, email addresses, or IM number or whatever, you know. So that's not really clear for me. If a parent wants to look up who his child is dealing with, he still can do that right now on Tier 1. He doesn't need to know what that person's telephone number is. That would be the only point to raise. And the other thing is that I don't see it as a breach of balance if the requester has to reveal something about himself because it takes him out of his anonymity. I mean, just the domain name registration does not take you out of the anonymity. If you just use it for email or other services like a DNS server or whatever, you're not really displaying yourself to the public, and I don't see a reason why someone should ask for your data if he doesn't provide your data as well. So that's the only two.
Yeah, Jordan, I'd like to explain a specific example of why a company like mine needs that information, and it isn't that we need that information in every instance when we check who is. We may check for the availability of a name because we're introducing a service or a product. That might be one reason we access who is. That's obviously a very different situation where we wouldn't, of course, need that kind of information, Todd. But the example that I've spoken about before of the phishing problems that companies like mine are having, we do have to have that information in order to be able to deal with a crime that we suspect, but we can't turn it over to law enforcement. They won't take it until we actually do some initial validation ourselves and have something to turn over to them.
Well, I understand that point, but don't you think if you would kind of make a WHOIS request and that person who's doing that phishing site and who's having this fraudulent behavior now finds out that you from AT&T are looking for him, don't you think he will quit the service? I mean, that's more or less what you're about, you know, that you want to quit him doing that service. That's what I heard during the data gathering and especially in the informal meeting in Rome, that the IP or IP lawyer asked that he really needs a telephone number because he could call that person up who's having a fraudulent behavior and telling him about it and make him stop. So that would be the first point of contact. If that doesn't work at all, you know, you still have to go to court and get a subpoena and sue that person. I mean, it might beat your purpose.
Tom, we do all that. We're very familiar with that, and we, of course, do follow applicable law. But I just think it's important as we think about the implementability of this. I don't want to get into a long argument about this. As we think about the implementability of this, as we go through this, we need to come back and sort of say what's implementable.
Well, just from a technical point of view, it's not a problem to implement a system with trusted spanning. I mean, CRISP has given us all the info, possibilities to do so.
Well, Jordan?
Thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, so we're running a bit over time, so I'm starting to watch the
clock. That was
going to
be my question, since we are over time. When do we plan to wrap up?
Yeah, let me, we're certainly not going to, I think, resolve this question today, obviously, but I think, you know, we have, you know, maybe seen some more perspectives and we can revise our proposal a little bit more. But I think, Steve, we will look to start to wrap this up momentarily. Do you have any other comments you want to make?
No, I'll pass.
Okay, so Kathy, why don't you make your comment, and then we'll see if we can't ramp this down and think about next steps.
Okay, just real fast, it sounds like, Marilyn, that you were posing some situations where it would be okay to disclose to the domain name holder, and then some situations where it wouldn't be. And those are the kinds of lines that it would be great to talk about drawing, because I agree there are some situations where you do want the disclosure and some situations where you don't. I just wanted to kind of emphasize again, you know, the concerns about the data that's being disclosed, identity theft, the stalking, you know, abuse, harassment. You know, there are good reasons from the free speech and privacy side to give people a heads up that somebody may be coming after them. But sounds like everybody's drawing lines. How do we continue that? Oh, I did also want to add that Thomas's discussion of the voluntary disclosure of data, that you certainly can put the data into the WHOIS. And also, based on brochures that I picked up in Rome, I see that certain countries are beginning to require that their own businesses, those holding themselves out to do business to the public, do business with consumers, which is not a fraction of the websites, I think, will have to put in countries have to put their data on their website, and it has to be accurate. So I think that, you know, the WHOIS may not be asked to do as much in the future as it's doing now. I think countries are stepping in to kind of draw the lines between commercial and non-commercial, and those commercial entities doing business with the public. I think those lines are being drawn internally by agencies that are kind of the equivalent of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission.
Actually, some of these lines are being drawn by court. I remember a recent decision here where a court basically said how many clicks away from a start page of a commercial web page identifying information may still be, I think they said, 3 clicks away is too much or something like that. So it's really about making the information available without going over to a different service like WHOIS. It is about making the information available inside the service on the web page. That's important to understand.
Okay. Well, we are going to need to wrap up the conversation. I think, you know, just to take away from this dialogue, I think, you know, we continue to struggle with the balance between, you know, contactability and privacy. I think, you know, one, Kathy's attempted to perhaps, you know, bridge that by creating the symmetry that Steve's indicated isn't really working for him, but, you know, between the data disclosure for the registrant and for the requester. Marilyn, I think, has proposed, and Thomas, to a certain extent, have proposed another idea that maybe we want to explore on the list or think about if there's a practical way to implement, which is to somehow differentiate between users or uses of the domain and make different data or contactability requirements based on who the user is or what the domain is being used for. We haven't really seen any concrete proposals there, and certainly if people think they have solutions that would be useful, I would encourage them to circulate them on the list. That might be another approach that makes sense, having the tiers be based on who the registrant is or how the domain's being used instead of who's accessing it.
Jordan, can I ask a third thing, which is how the data is going to be used that's being accessed?
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, a third area that I guess relates more closely to the first is, you know, start to differentiate between, you know, to make exceptions for the notification based on what the purpose of the data is. So, I think these are all potentially useful topics for us to approach more. We're obviously running out of time. Generally, I am going to write up sort of my summary of the of where we stand on the tiered access in terms of some things seem to be relatively more consensus around and some less, and I'll try to distribute those to the list for some further discussion. It may be that sort of approach is all we're able to agree upon for this pass of the report. It may be we're able to get to some more specifics as well. We'll see what happens. But I do encourage, obviously, the priority over the next couple of days is getting the sections of the report drafted and complete so that Barbara and I can assemble them. And then, you know, next week we'll start to see, you know, where the task force views consensus and not in terms of what people have submitted. But in the meantime, you know, if we do want to see some productive work done on this tiered access side, I would encourage, you know, if people have concrete ideas coming out of this topic or suggestions they could make along one of those approaches, certainly making them on the list. We're starting to see a little bit more dialogue there. It might be helpful.
Working from the compromise proposal or just starting new?
The compromise proposal would be a great place. I mean, some of the approaches, like, you know, what Marilyn's proposed in terms of differentiating between types of users, you know, Tom proposed differentiating between uses, those probably may not, you know, it may not make as much sense to start from your proposal in those cases. But, you know, I think people are free to work from whatever they think that makes the most sense. But I think, you know, it's helped. The compromise proposal, I think, represents that, you know, the kind of thinking we need to do to try to recognize needs on the other side of the debate. And, you know, as Maggie put it, you know, not draw lines in the sand, but see where we can't come up with some clever solutions that are going to meet a broad range of needs pretty well. Any other comments or?
Sure, just a quick one. I understand you and Bruce and the other co-chairs are going to have a conference call to plan what we would talk about on the afternoon, the cross task force meeting we're going to have?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. I haven't received any information about it yet. Okay, well, we'll wrap this call up then. Like I said, please get your contributions, except for Maggie, who's done. Get your contributions for the interim report, I mean the initial report, by Wednesday, and Barbara and I will work as hard as we can to make sure that the assembled report is out by Friday for discussion next week. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan.
Bye. Bye.